This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
The following podcast is hashtag Boone approved. It's time for another edition of the Brett Boone Podcast.
Remember when me and you almost went to blows? Lou sent me down three times too, so I know what you're talking about.
With your host, MLB All-Star, Brett Boone.
Bottom line is, you will become a successful major league hitter by hitting pitchers' mistakes.
As he sits down with his sports and entertainment friends from around the world.
You are not going to be a successful major league hitter if you hit pitchers' pitches.
This isn't just any former jocks podcast.
To change the outcome, you got to change the income. You got to change what goes in. Then that changes what goes out.
Often duplicated, but never replicated. Just like his bat flip.
Okay, now the party starts. The responsibility starts now.
Now in its fourth year, this is the one and only Brett Boone Podcast.
Welcome to the Brett Boone Podcast. I'm Brett Boone. Today on the program, we've got another knuckleball. We had Charlie Huff last week. A buddy of mine is going to come along today, and we're going to talk a lot of things. He pitched in the big leagues for 17 years, finished with a 3.73 earned run average. He's currently the radio analyst for the Diamondbacks. That's the Diamondbacks of Arizona. I'm really looking forward to talking to our next guest. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Tom Candiotti. Candy, thanks for coming on the show.
Booney, thanks for having me, buddy. It's been a long time.
It's been a while, and we're old golf buddies, and I know you love to play. We were talking the other day off air, and I was telling you about my putting woes, but I'm getting better. So we'll see. Hopefully I'll get that handicapped out. What are you at now? What's your index?
Well, it says, I think, 8, but yeah. I've been playing a lot of golf, so it's probably a little bit better than that right now. That's just kind of the nature of Arizona, right? You play until the heat gets hitting, and then once it gets hot, your game goes south.
That's right. That's right. I'm at an 8.2. I'm at an 8 right now. 8 even, I think. Yeah, I might be an 8.1.
Man, we used to be good. What happened?
Yeah. I'm getting old, man.
Just of course, I can never hit the ball like you either.
This old guy stuff's getting all of us. been with the Diamondbacks a long time. Let's talk about the run a year ago. If you predicted it, you're not being truthful. The fact that they went to the World Series, I think, awesome thing to watch. And it just shows you what a team I don't know what happens behind the scenes in that clubhouse, the camaraderie. As a player, I went through phases of my career. I don't know if you did, where they used to tell me, well, chemistry means for a lot. And I was always from the school of you get the best talent, and you steamroll your opposition. I did that when I went to Atlanta in 1999, and I thought we're just better than everybody else. Fast forward a little bit to my career in Seattle. And we had a great team, but the chemistry was unbelievable, and I became a believer in that. Obviously, that Diamondback team, headed up by Torrey Lovello a year ago, had a lot of that going on. Everybody counted them out at every turn, and they just kept winning. You had a front row seat. Give me a little bit in a nutshell what that was like.
You know, it was a pretty amazing season, honestly. you know, they had a lot of young kids that they were bringing up. This is last spring training, and you're kind of looking at the team and you're going, well, okay, you know, Ketel Marte kind of been around, but, you know, is he on the decline or not? I'm not really sure. Christian Walker at first, all right, he can bang the ball a little bit. You know, we had a little bit of talent, but then all these young kids kind of started to emerge. And with Corbin Carroll, you saw the talent out there, but you know how it is when you're a rookie. Sometimes you're not quite sure, you know, how is he going to be against left-handed pitchers? You know, Alec Thomas, who's just a phenomenal defender, but can he hit enough in the big leagues? I mean, there were so many question marks with it. And then the season started, and right off the bat, we were playing the Dodgers, and I don't think they were ready to play us. And this team just ran. I mean, Torrey Lovello did a great job, and seemed like every time we got on first base, we ran. We stole second. We stole third. And it was like the Dodgers were just unprepared. And that kind of carried over a little bit. And then the guys started to believe in themselves a little bit. And then they, you know, that all-star area, you know, they kind of took a dive. You know, I said, well, okay, you know, here comes, you know, they're not used to playing a full year, you know, with this kind of intensity and stuff. And then, you know, they got it back. And they were really fun to watch. And it wasn't like they were hitting a million home runs or anything, but man, they would get on base and just I think the perception of their speed, I mean, it put so much pressure on the defense. But then they limped into the playoffs. So we get into the playoffs and we go, you know, right away we go into Milwaukee and we're going, oh man, you know, Corbin Burns, no chance, you know, we're not going to be able to hit him. And Woodruff, who wasn't out yet at that time, you know, he's dominated us, and he couldn't make the call, so they put Peralta in, I think it was. But either way, we end up winning two games, and we're going, oh, that was pretty lucky. And then we go right from Milwaukee right to L.A. We're going, oh, this is going to be like a slaughter. And I'd never seen Kershaw.
That's a combo.
I call him. He just got absolutely clobbered. I never seen anything like it. And then we end up, you know, beating the Dodgers. And now we go to go play the Phillies. We go into Philadelphia and just got boat raced for two games. And we came back, it'll be nice to win a game or two at home for the fans. And we win all the next four games, right? And we're going, how is this happening? You know, we're nowhere near as good as the Phillies are. Then we're getting ready to, okay, we're going to go to the World Series now. And that was the one team that I thought we might be able to beat was the Rangers. The way, you know, as you start prepping for the game and you're kind of doing the matchups, and I thought maybe our starters were a little bit better. And I think we'd probably win that series. And we got killed. So that's baseball, right?
It's amazing because you mentioned the Texas Rangers. They weren't exactly the favorite to win the World Series. They limped into the playoffs. Different. They won more games, but they had to beat. They just had to beat the Mariners in the last series, 2 out of 4, and they win the division. They end up losing 3 out of 4, lose that division, have to go on the road instead of starting at home. And they kind of had that trail, you know, led by a couple guys that kind of burst onto the scene in Texas, and it was a great run. I think, you know, different candy than when we played the playoff dynamic is so much different with the 12 teams making it to the postseason. Like you said, you just walked through the Arizona and beating Milwaukee. Those two big guys at the front of that rotation ended up being one because Woodruff did go down. But to beat them and then to go into and sweep the 111-win Dodgers, that just doesn't happen. The thing that really turned me, though, is you talked about that Philly series, and I think you were probably you had an up close and personal seat to it. But I watched the atmosphere in Philadelphia, and I thought, this is too much for any team. I don't care who you are. It was just electric, and you're right. It was over. Philly was going to beat him. It wasn't even a contest, and all of a sudden, they come clawing back and win the next three and then go back and beat him, and I just thought, at that point, I'm picking Arizona. I said, I don't care who they're playing. Arizona's winning the World Series. It wasn't meant to be, but an unbelievable run. They put themselves on the map. Torrey Lovello did obviously a great job. You get to see it every day. And the thing that pisses me off, I want this out of you, remember Mad Dog Russo goes on the air and he's going to retire, right?
Yeah.
He's going to retire if you go to the World Series. Well, why didn't he retire? That's the weakest move I've ever seen. You're going to put your, excuse my language, you're going to put your balls on the line. You follow up with it. He didn't do it.
Well, he changed it. He said, I'm going to retire from radio.
Oh, he's such a, no. It's such a clown move.
I hear you. We're with that, too. We were all waiting for it.
Yeah.
Be great, you know. And I'm sure the players were probably, like, all into that also. Yeah. You know, because I know Torrey was. Torrey says, like, in our little manager scrums, you know, where he's pretty candid with, like, you know, just us radio guys and stuff. And right. He said, I keep notes on everybody, what they say.
That's right.
And so he's all into that.
Yeah. You mentioned Corbin Carroll, obviously, is turning into a superstar at just a young age. Stole 50 bags last year. And he is kind of their up and coming. He's the face of the program for the Arizona Diamondbacks. To me, what I was impressed with, the more I watched this team through the playoffs, was the shortstop. I think his name's Perdomo. The catcher Marino came up with some big hits. Gurriel, he just got a new contract with the Diamondbacks. There were some unsung heroes. Marte and Corbin Carroll, they're kind of the face of the franchise right now. But a lot of unsung heroes did some big time work in those postseasons to get them where they were.
Well, Marino especially, you know, that kid was really something behind the plate. I mean, he really handles his pitching well. And you know what it's like when you have a really young catcher coming in with a little bit of a veteran staff, you know, when you're talking about Gallen and Merrill Kelly and stuff. But, you know, he was, like, amazing back there. And offensively, it seemed like he was really getting it offensively where he could just wasn't an out. You know, he was doing a little bit of damage, not just a little ground ball through the right hole. You know, he was pounding the ball. So we had to keep him in the lineup, and Torrey got everything he could out of him because he knew, you know, he's a game changer for us. And Perdomo, that kid, I mean, you would love him on your team. I mean, he does everything. He's the happiest kid. You know, he works hard. He's out there every single day. And he knows he's not probably as talented as a lot of the, you know, the really good shortstops out there. But, you know, he does all the little things. You know, if you need to get a bunt down, he's going to get it down. You need him hit to the right side, he's going to do that. Because you know how playoff baseball is a little different than, you know, during the season. Sure. Where you got to run, you got to bunt, you got to hit behind guys. You got to do all these little things that help you win games. And Perdomo is one of those guys that can do that. Remember, was it David Eckstein? Remember?
Yes.
So he's kind Catalyst. Of that a little bit in the way that he can, you know, just – he's always a pest. And Perdomo was kind of like that. And then he started running into a few of them. And I've seen him this spring, and he's motivated again. And so even though he kind of flies a little bit under the radar, that kid's going to be pretty good.
I think the thing that was so great for the people that don't get to watch a team like the Diamondbacks all year, they only won 84 games. They got to see what the Diamondbacks have. They've added to it. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. They've added to that team of a year ago. I think they're even stronger this year. I want to talk about this year. Obviously, the talk of baseball with the huge signings at the beginning of the offseason, and we're going to stay over there in the National League West, was the Dodgers. They're a super team. I don't know. I forget, you know, I start naming off Dodgers and I think, oh my gosh, they have him too. You know, you got Walker Buehler. Is he healthy? Urias, we all know what happened there. He was their best pitcher a year ago. He's not available. Kershaw's back. He signed back. Only fitting, I think, is going to be at the back of that rotation. But Yamamoto, who we haven't seen much of him, never pitched in the big leagues, but by all accounts, he's everything that the press builds him up to be. The guy for me they got from Tampa, Glasnow, is a game changer. His only problem is health, but they are loaded. And obviously you've got Freddie Freeman, who's probably my favorite hitter to watch in the league, just a pure kind of old school hitter. He's just great. Mookie Betts, obviously a perennial MVP, and then the best player in the world who's not going to pitch this year. He'll be back next year to pitch. They don't have enough rotation spots for all the stars they have. Talk about the Dodgers and what you look for them in that crowded division. And sneakily, the well, we'll get to them next. Talk about the Dodgers a little bit.
Well, we haven't faced them yet in spring training, but you know, when you're, when I'm watching them on TV, they are it's a scary team. I mean, it really is. I mean, at the very top of the order, you know, when you're looking at Mookie, they can put him anywhere in the lineup, right? You know, they can put Freddie really anywhere in the lineup. Otani is there. Will Smith is kind of an unsung hero over there.
Great player.
Great player. You know, he's a clutch hitter, you know, good catcher, handles everything great. Muncy is off to a really good spring. I think he's got a couple dongs this spring already. He could have a huge year for him too. I mean, up and down. I'm kind of anxious to see how Gavin Lux plays out this year at shortstop. I think that's going to be a key marker for them, you know, because that's a pretty, you know, pretty good position. You got to be strong in that position, you know, especially with the pitching staff, unless you're, you know, just striking everybody out. But, you know, he's a really good hitter also. I mean, up and down. Outman, you know, with a year underneath him out in center field, you know, he kind of reminds me of a little mini Bellinger in a way. Still has a lot of swing and miss in his game, but he can go get him in the outfield, and he's got pop in his bat. You know, so if he figures it out a little bit, you know, he could be a pretty dangerous player. The one pitcher that really stood out to me last year, I go, this guy is going to be a stud, is Miller. That guy has got an arm on him. I mean, it's like an easy 97, an easy 98. I mean, I'm going, I have to keep looking at the radar gun. I said, did it really go that fast? I mean, he is just popping it. And he's got good stuff, too. You know, not a whole lot of room in that rotation, but it seems like they got a bunch of guys that are just kind of always knocking on the door.
Let's move down to the Padres. Also in your division a year ago, about as disappointing a team as there was out there a year ago with that talent and that roster they had. They obviously are going to lose Snell. Soto went on to the Yankees. I think they got a great guy in return in King. I think he's going to fit really good in that rotation with Musgrove and Darvish. Still getting old. Darvish getting a little bit older, but good enough where he's still a formidable opponent. Talk a little bit about that Padre ball club.
Yeah, you know, they were scary about this time last year, you know, when they had Soto and you know, they were talking, you know, and rightfully so that, you know, hey, Dodgers got to fear them. And it looked like it on paper. But, you know, Manny was end up getting hurt a little bit, I think, with his arm. But he could, you know, he's still a dangerous hitter out there. Soto probably didn't have the greatest year, like a Soto year. But still, I think he still hit 280-something. And, you know, still was a, you know, every time he came up, he could do some damage. You know, Bogarts, I thought when he was coming over, I said, oh, man, this guy, from what I saw when he was with the Red Sox, this guy's like a pure hitter to me, and he's got a little pop. Maybe it's not going to hit, you know, 30 home runs, but he's going to bang the ball all around the place. They had so much talent on that team. And the rotation also. In fact, I worked with a kid for about a whole fall league here a couple years ago, knuckleball guy, Matt Waldron. And so, you know, I spent a lot of time with Matt trying to develop him in his knuckleball. And he started to come on a little bit later in the season. And I think he might be one of their pitchers this year, or he'll be close. If not, you know, I know A.J. Preller really likes him because he's the one that gave me a call to try to work with him. So he's a guy to kind of keep an eye on. He's really got a nice knuckleball. And he's a little bit like me, but with better stuff. He still likes to throw a slider.
He's got that big hook. Is he at the big hook?
No, no, he's got
that's the Candiani hook. That was the difference.
I remember throwing one hook to a guy named Brett Boone. It took me deep.
And that's the only pitch I could hit. I'd sit on it. If he throws me the knuckleball, I'm out.
Curveballs now. That's it. I'm never throwing him another curveball because he would just never even swing at a knuckleball. So no, that was the home run that you knocked out of the park in Dodger State. I remember that one. But yeah, we had some good battles. I love those battles, man. It was great.
So moving on to the Giants. And the Giants, for me, Bob Melvin a year ago was the Padre manager. Now Schilt's come in. Melvin went down the freeway to San Francisco. I look at this team. Nobody's really talking about the Giants. But I look at them. They got Lee, the Korean kid, paid him a ton of money. Supposedly he's the real deal. Just signed Chapman. Really good player to play third base for him. Robbie Ray, who signed the big deal with Seattle coming off of Cy Young, had a little bit of a disappointing year. He's going to the Giants. That's a sneaky move for me. Jordan Hicks is going there. You've got Webb at the top of that rotation. And I'm hearing it's a possibility they're the ones that are going to sign Snell. They signed Snell. That division changes. And now all of a sudden you got an improving Diamondback team from a year ago who went to the World Series. You got the Padres, who about as underachieving as I could imagine. And then you got the super team, the LA Dodgers. It's probably going to end up being the best division in baseball. If Snell goes there, the Giants are a contender.
You know, I almost expect him to go there. You know, Bob Melvin is a huge addition to that team, right? And, you know, he loved Chapman when he was with the A's, went out and they end up getting him that done. He really likes Snell. I can see that possibly happening too, you know, when, and especially when you're a free agent, when there's a team that you know the manager already, you know, that really helps out. So I wouldn't be surprised if Snell does go over there. And I'm actually shocked that he hasn't even signed yet. I mean, he's got two coming off a Cy Young year. He's got two of them under his belt already. You know, I mean, he's a difference maker. And so, you know, if the Giants get him, like you said, you know, they have a lot. They kind of go under the radar also. Doval in the bullpen, that guy's electric. I mean, yeah. You see him come in. I mean, he just brings it, man. And he's like fearless out there. You know, the Giants, you know, really have something in him. You know, I'm not sure about the rest of their bullpen, how it's going to play out yet, but I know they got that closer. And if they do get Snell, that's a wicked rotation that they're going to have, and you're going to have to deal with them.
And as a pitcher, why wouldn't you want to go to San Francisco? You know, from right center over, it's the biggest park in baseball. I was laughing when Ohtani hadn't made his decision yet, you know, and they're asking me, what do you think? I said, well, I think he's either going to go back to the Angels or he's going to go to the Dodgers. It's right down the freeway. He stays at home, doesn't have to move his family. Obviously, he's comfortable in Southern California. Why would he go to San Francisco? I said, it's the biggest ballpark in the world, especially for a left-handed hitter. What Bonds did there is even more remarkable because of the size of the ballpark. But it's a great place to pitch. So from a... Obviously, in today's game, the money's a little bit different. There's a lot of money out there, so I understand that factor. But if you're a pitcher and you're thinking, having a big ballpark to pitch in, that's a pretty good sign for me to go there. Just like a hitter, if I'm going to sign a free agent, and you're going to, I get to play in Philadelphia or I get to play in Cincinnati, it's pretty intriguing from an offensive standpoint. Quite the contrary on the if I'm going to San Francisco. I don't want to go to San Francisco. I hit one of my strengths was hitting the ball the other way. Why am I going to go to that park? I'm going to go to that park and die, and I'm going to end up being a pull hitter, pull me out of my game. So those are all factors that players, at the end of the day, they do consider.
You probably would have led the league in triples if you went to San Francisco out there with all that space out there. But
that's a lot.
You're right. I mean, it always amazes me, like, how great Bonds was, and especially playing, you know, in that ballpark. And it wasn't like even Candlestick, the years he was at Candlestick, was like an easy place to hit in either. No. You know, that was always kind of a fun place to pitch because it was horrible conditions all the time. So as a pitcher, it's great because, you know, everyone else doesn't like it. You know, and Bonds was just like so incredible. Ohtani, I mean, every time I've seen that guy, I was last year – he was playing the D-backs. We were playing the Angels. And he hit a ball off Tommy Henry, a left-handed pitcher for the D-backs. I think it was like 468. It looked like it was about 568. I mean, he hit it like way up in Anaheim through or on top of one of those little alleyways up there. And I just was like, I looked over next to the booth next to me, and Mark Langston's doing the game for the Angels. And he looks at me and he just goes, "Are you like freaking kidding me?"
Unbelievable.
It's amazing, unbelievable. You know, what he's going to do.
Yeah, it really is. The playoff format current, do you like it? And is there anything you would change?
I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect for real.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You know, I didn't necessarily really like it, but it really helped the D-backs get in. You know, so it made it kind of fun, you know, selfishly for that, you know, with a lot of the teams getting in. But I think teams are doing things differently now instead of really trying to load up maybe early. Now they kind of wait to see where they're at. And if they can try to sneak into a wild card spot, maybe it'll make that trading deadline a little bit more, you know, fun for people. More teams are involved. They can't just like give their players away so much, you know, as maybe they did in the past. You know, so that part is pretty good. But I don't know. It seems like there's so many, like, postseason games right. Where, it's a little bit different than just having your division winners maybe. I remember that even changed, like, at least during my career. What your first year was probably
92.
Yeah. And so I think that changed a little bit, like, right about after the strike maybe or something like that. I don't know. But it's a little bit different now, you know, enabling some teams to get in. And I guess that's a fun thing for a lot of teams, a lot of cities, that they can kind of do that. But, you know, you'd think that the better teams would really kind of rise, but it hurt the Dodgers last year.
Sure.
They just all up everybody. Then they had to sit for, like, it seemed like 2 weeks. And they had to play the D-backs, who just continued to play. And, you know, like I said, the Dodgers didn't look like they were ready. And I think that was probably that layoff that they had.
I think it's changing so much, Tommy, because when you first came into the league, I mean, you had to win the division. That's just the way it was. It was a big time marathon. It's like, and you knew at the end of the year, whoever was in the postseason, they were definitely the best teams in the game that year, without a doubt. Usually the best team ended up winning the World Series with this format. And I go back and forth because I like to keep the game as much the same as it always has been. But I understand as time moves on and life changes and dynamics change, we all know the bottom line is revenue and money. That's what's going to move the needle. A part of me does like the new format because you mentioned the more cities involved. The one thing I'd like to see, and there's already too many postseason games, but what I'd like to see is somehow I don't know what they're going to have to do as far as convincing the players, because the season's already so long with 162 games. But once you get to the postseason, all right, fine. If I just concede and say 12 teams, that's the way we're going to go. That's the formula right now that's working. Fans love it. More cities involved. I get it. But I don't like, and I understand from a game standpoint, the three-game series, the five-game series. I think to get a true winner at the end, the seven-game series are the way to go, because that tests your depth. That gets you into your fourth and fifth starter. You have these three-game series, you're only facing the one and two. And if you've got a one and two that are horses in a five-game series, they both pitch twice. So I don't know. I don't know how you do it, but I'm trying to find a way to, how do we get the best team standing at the end? And usually the longer the series is, the best team will come out and prevail, just like the course of a 162-game season. Usually the team that wins the most games, usually they're the best team that year. And then the postseason starts, but I don't know. I'm just throwing stuff against the wall. One day, maybe something will stick.
No, I get it. You know, right now the format is the hottest team is going to win. You know, you get hot,
yeah,
probably going to win. But like with the D-backs last year, I mean, it was kind of a shame in a way that I think it was game three or game four in the World Series. They're going to an opener. You got Joe Manaply starting, you know, so a team that's got a couple good starters and a young kid, Brandon Fott, who was, you know, starting to get a little bit hot, but still you're like kind of relying on Gallen and Merrill Kelly. And you know, that's pretty much all we had. So, you know, when you're playing a long series, you're going to get exposed if you just have two pitchers.
Yeah. All right. Switch topics a little bit. I want to talk about your journey. Really interesting. I read for the first time and I had no idea, Tommy, you started in Victoria, Canada. I've been there. And in that independent league way back when, I think it was 79, you went to college at St. Mary's. You went undrafted, go to Victoria, Canada, and I'm reading about you sleeping in a sleeping bag
true story.
We both have kids that are playing baseball. I think you have a son right now playing at the U of A. Yep. I've got a son actually playing in the Frontier League, an independent league. He's about to go there in about a month. But what a journey you had to pitch in the big leagues for 17 years, and it started out undrafted in Victoria, Canada. Couldn't be farther away from probably what you grew up, the city you grew up in. Take me through that a little bit. Victoria, actually, very beautiful city. I've been there.
Booney, I'm the luckiest guy. Seriously. I mean, the way stuff happened for me, it was just incredible when you look back on it. So I left St. Mary's. You know, I had a very good college career, and I think after my junior year, I was an All-American honorable mention guy, and threw a lot harder than you remember me throwing at that time, but hurt my arm right towards the end of my junior year. Never really came back. You know, it came back all right, but not like it once was. And so I had didn't get drafted, went to all those little tryout camps, but couldn't get signed by anybody. So the catcher on St. Mary's, a guy by the name of Ron Colburn, had a tryout with the Victoria Muscles. They were playing in Bend, Oregon at the time, and were the Phillies organization. So he goes, "Hey, you want to come with me?" I go, "Sure." So I just grabbed my fishing pole and I said, "All right, I'll go with you, and I'll just hang out." So I go up there and we get to the ballpark, and you know, he's got his tryout down there for the independent team, the Victoria Muscles. And I see a scout in the stands named Eddie Bachman, longtime Philly scout.
I know Eddie Bachman.
So Eddie was there and he recognized me because I played on one of his teams, like in the summer ball, a Connie Mack team. And he goes, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Well, I'm just watching Ron try out." And he goes, "Well, why don't you go try out?" And I said, "Well, I was never invited to try out." And so he went down and talked to the manager, a guy by the name of Bill Brick. And so Brick, he comes back and he says, "He wants you to throw a bullpen." Well, I don't have a glove. I don't have spikes. I don't have anything. So I went down there, borrowed a guy's glove, pitched in my tennis shoes and my blue jean cutoff shorts, and he signed me right on the spot. And unfortunately, my buddy didn't make it. So now I'm stuck in Bend, Oregon with like $5 to my name, and I don't have anything. I don't even have my
glove. You got a fishing pole.
I have nothing. But they're on the road, so that's good. They gave me, I think it was $400 Canadian was the contract, which at that time was like $340 American. So I had some money, you know, that when I got paid, they gave me the $5 a day meal money at that time. And so we get back to Victoria, and I had nowhere to sleep. So I just stayed in the training room for like a couple nights. And then I ended up being friends with one of the guys on the team as I got to know him, and he let me sleep on his couch. And then the team was owned by an associate producer of Saturday Night Live. And back then, this was 1979, Saturday Night Live was a really cool big thing, right? And so Bill Murray came out to hang out with us. And so he'd take BP with us and all this kind of stuff. It was just a blast. He took us to the discos at that time. Meatballs just came out. I think we went to the movie theater with him. And one of the funniest things ever is we were in Walla Walla, Washington, and I taught him how to dine and dash. And I'd never seen him laugh so hard. It's like five of us running out of the restaurant with Bill, just running down the streets of Walla Walla, because we technically didn't have a lot of money to pay for a, it was at a Mexican restaurant. We didn't have enough money to pay. So by the time we drank the margaritas anyway. And so that was always kind of fun. And then after that season was over, they sold me. This is how the independent teams make money, right? So they're going to sell you. They sold me to the Royals for $2,000. And I said, wow, this is great. So I went to spring training with Kansas City, the minor league camp, and played the whole year in 1980 with them, like in a little bit in single A and mostly in double A. And then I was drafted by the Milwaukee Brewers. You know, I guess you don't have that three-year rule in the minor leagues when you're, I don't know, you go through the independent team or whatever, but they drafted me. And so I became a member of the Brewers. And right after that, I had to go down to see Dr. Job because my elbow was still kind of just barking. And he said, you need this operation. And he goes, I've done eight of these so far, and only one guy has ever come back from it, and that's Tommy John. And he goes, if you're a prospect, I'll be glad to do it. And I said, well, they just put me on the 40-man roster. So, yeah, I think I'm a prospect. And he goes, so he did the operation. So I was number 9 of all time, the second guy to ever come back from Tommy John. So I had to wait out a whole year in 1982 and 1983. I went to like double A, triple A in the big leagues. This is all before I threw knuckleballs. So it was all, I get to the big leagues, and I was up and down for a few years. And then, you know, my stuff just didn't play, you know, like you said, good curveball, threw strikes, but very short on the fastball. And I went and started working on a knuckleball, and went to winter ball, went to Puerto Rico, and the Indians, I was a minor league free agent, and the Indians offered me a contract. And like, as soon as I got to Tucson, where they trained, they acquired Phil Negro. And so Phil [S2] Wow. [S1] Was 47 years old at the time, and they acquired him. So now I had a guy that I could talk to about this pitch, because I didn't know much about it other than I could grip it and I could throw it hard. That was it. And so Phil was like my pitching coach. And so we went, you know, every single day I played catch with Phil. I was able to watch him pitch. He was stuck with me that whole 1986. And here I am, you know, I wasn't quite a knuckleball pitcher yet. I was still more of a pitcher that threw a knuckleball. And so it was like even in a head and a count, you know, I still had a curveball that I could throw for a strike and kind of keep me in counts a little bit. And that year I ended up winning 16 games and completed 17 of them. And I think I had like 250 or 260 innings pitched or something like that. And it kind of launched me. And then that same year, I was able to meet Charlie Huff. So I'm throwing a side in Texas, and I got Phil Negro and Charlie Huff. To me, you know, and Joe Negro worked with me a lot also. But those two guys were like, you know, they were the knuckleball geniuses, right? And so I'm trying to throw a bullpen, and I'm like, I've never been so nervous in my life with these two guys watching me try to throw this pitch. And, you know, they were the two most awesome guys, and still talk to Charlie. In fact, I talked to Charlie last week, and, you know, he's there with the Dodgers right now, you know, as a minor league coach. And it's always great to catch up with him and stuff. But he helped me out tremendously, you know, so I had help with him and with Phil when I first started out, and then it just kind of blossomed.
It's pretty awesome because, yeah, when we faced each other, I just, all right, here's Tom Candiotti's a knuckleballer. So I didn't know any of the backstory. There's always an interesting, it seems like for the knuckleballers, it always came to, for something happened and you know what? I was on the side and there's this story to it. You know, I came up with Timmy Wakefield and I started with Timmy in A-ball. He was with the Pirates and I'd never faced a knuckleball. You know, I went to USC. I was a college kid, but I've never faced a knuckleball. Now all of a sudden I'm facing Wake. And by the way, I didn't like it. None of us like it, by the way. None of us like it. Charlie Huff, I used to hit when I was in high school in the off season. He'd come out and he'd get ready for the season and just throw BP to the local high school kids. He'd throw me a knuckleball once in a while. Didn't like it. Liked his fat fastballs, but didn't like the knuckleball. It seems like everybody, you get to meet Nikra. It seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong, for the knuckleballers, because it's such a small community, it's almost like you're an NFL punter. You all hang out together. And the guys I came up with were Huff Wakefield, the Nikra brothers, Hoyt Wilhelm, and someone else I faced in my career was R.A. Dickey, who went back and forth. He went from a regular pitcher with a knuckleball to a knuckleballer back and forth. But is it kind of a community where if you're in a city and there's another knuckleballer, hey, how you doing? And you guys talk and kind of share information?
Without a doubt. And I'll tell you a funny story with Wake, why he wore number 49. Because he thought 49 was a knuckleball pitcher number. And I was given 49 just because it was available. That was it. I never was able to ask for a number or anything like that. Charlie Huff happened to be 49. I think Phil was like 35, I think, when we were together. But it's kind of a little community like that. So that's why Wake was wearing 49, because he thought it was a knuckleball thing, which was always kind of cracked me up. I said, no, Timmy, it's just what they gave me. That was it. I'm not going to argue with anybody. I shouldn't even be here, you know, so... But it is a community. I just got a call the other day from Cincinnati to work with a kid who was a number one draft pick out of Stanford, utility infielder. Remember Alex Blandino?
Yeah.
And so Alex is trying to convert to be a knuckleball pitcher. So we had talked, and I went out and watched his bullpen. And this week I'll go out and watch one of his, as soon as he gets in the game, I'll be able to watch him a little bit. You know, all these guys that are trying to figure out, you know, how to keep themselves in the major leagues one way or the other.
Right.
You know, the knuckleball is a thing. It happened with Charlie that way. You know, it kind of it happened with me. It happened with Tim, you know, and, you know, Timmy, which was amazing. And really Charlie also, but more so Timmy, is he didn't come from a pitching background. You know, you look at his delivery and his windup before, you could tell he never really pitched. He was like playing catch, you right. know. So it's amazing what he was able to do in his career and the amount of, you know, how long he kept himself in the game and how successful he was, relieving or starting or whatever role it was. It was pretty amazing. And so, yeah, we're all a kind of a fraternity. We all still talk. We all, you know, it's all, they should have some kind of knuckleball tournament or something like that. You
there,
know,
there should be a reality show.
Yeah, you there you go. Right? Well, they had one a little bit with Wake and R.A. at one point. In fact, the guy that won it, I can't remember his name, Josh. I want to say Josh Fields. I know it's not him, but it was he played for Tampa Bay, a little bit of third baseman, but he could throw a knuckleball. He won that reality show, and he came to spring training with the Diamondbacks. And I end up working with him for like a whole spring, you know, but he had decent knuckleball. But a lot of guys have knuckleballs until they get on a mound. And it's
right.
very different.
Well, you know what it's like walking around with your teammates. Us, we're down the line getting loose, right? Let's just typical so day true. At the ballpark. You roll in. We're out there for position players. Stretch. We stretch. We throw. Me and Johnny Olerud every day. It's knuckleball time. We're not getting loose. You know, it's 3:30 in the afternoon. I don't have to have my arm ready till 7. So it's knuckleball time for us. And some days we had a really good one. You know, if my nails got to a certain length, it's like I could make it dance a little bit. But you're right. Different practicing your knuckleball on the side with a buddy where, hey, that was a pretty good one. Versus, okay, you got to have a pretty good one, and it's got to be every time. And by the way, you also have to be able to throw a strike with it. It's a different game. I just think it's such a cool position for a Tom Candiotti or a Charlie Huff or an R.A. Dickey now, you know. We lost Timmy Wakefield. What a sad deal that was, you know, recently. But there's just guys that have done it at the big league level, at a high level. There's not too many of you guys out there. So it seems like anytime anybody's got a knuckleball guy or a guy that's working on a knuckleball, it's like either call Candiotti, you call Charlie Huff, or you call R.A. Dickey. Those are the three experts kind of on the planet. So you're in a real unique position. I couldn't imagine everybody is like, oh, he's got a knuckleball. There's Tom Candiotti. Go talk to him. Whereas hitters, there's a million hitters to choose from of, hey, go get a hitting lesson from him or him or him. There's a million of us, but there's very few knuckleball pitchers.
You know, it's really funny you say that about Olerud, because I was teammates with him for about half a year with the Blue Jays, and that's all we did was play catch with a knuckleball. But every time we went to someplace, we'd go in and play the Twins, and here comes Kirby Puckett. Here, check my knuckleball out. He'll throw it to you. You know, you get into Atlanta, Mark Lemke, oh, I got my knuckleball. Here it is. What do you think? You know, Wade Boggs had a good knuckleball. Knuckleball, right? And until you get on the mound and until a batter stands up there, and until the umpire says, you know, play ball, and then there's 50,000 people in the stands, now you got to throw this ball that doesn't spin over the plate. It's, you know, it's really something when you really, you know, think about, you know, how difficult that really is.
Take me through a week. Tom Candiotti, the knuckleballer. Tom Candiotti, when you were a conventional pitcher. Getting ready for that, let's say every fifth day. You guys, you pitchers, we don't pay much attention to you, but you have your in-between starts, things you do. And it's one day, it's running, it's band work, it's whatever you do. Was there a difference for you preparing your preparation as a knuckleballer versus a contemporary type pitcher? Was there any difference?
Yeah, there was. When I became a knuckleball pitcher, you know, I threw so much more because it was important to me every day that I got there. I never took a day off from throwing and to develop the feel, because sometimes, you know, you have that, you know, you have that thought like, oh man, what if I don't have it today? I'm facing the Reds. Right. What if I don't have it? I got to make sure I have this pitch every single day. I don't care if it's playing catch with a buddy or just throwing, you know, maybe 10 of them on a mound or something like that. But every single day, I'd have to play catch, and I'd have to always also make sure my nails were right, you know, because the worst thing I start getting is I got a little bit older was, you know, nail care became really important to me because I cracked nails. I gripped the ball really hard. I really got my index finger and my second finger really in there. And it seemed like right after that strike, the balls got a little harder, but my nails broke all the time. And so I'd have to go down to the nail salon, and they put these things called acrylics on them. So it looked really weird. Like, you know, they just didn't look like real nails. They looked like they were like painted over, kind of like with a plastic thing or something like that. But it kept them from breaking. And that's the only way I could really throw the ball, because I put so much pressure in there, you know, where, you know, some guys like Charlie didn't have quite as much pressure. We compared grips, you know, all the time. Yeah. I had a million questions for him, and same with Negro. But for some reason, for me to take the spin off the ball, I really had to get my nails like really in there and then let it go. You know, especially early in my career when I was more of a pitcher that threw a knuckleball, that was my out pitch. You know, when I got two strikes, then I'm going to let this knuckleball go, and I don't care where it goes. Right. But then they taught me that, look, that's counterproductive. You know, you have to throw one, you know, hopefully just wiggles up there a little bit, learn how to change speeds with it just a little bit. So when you throw your duds, maybe the timing's off a little bit for a hitter. Maybe he's a little bit out in front of it, or you get a cheap foul ball or maybe a pop up or something like that. So learn how to change speeds, learn how to throw strikes, take some of the movement out of it, but every once in a while, you can go ahead and let that one go when you're 0-2 and you don't really care about
where it goes. You just want to completely embarrass me. We talked about your curveball, and that's why you were different. You know, I had Charlie on the podcast a week ago, and we talked about Charlie was kind of a guy where he was living and dying with it. He didn't have a secondary pitch. It's like, Booney, 2-0, you're getting a knuckleball. 0-2, you're getting a knuckleball with me. You know, once in a while, Charlie'd zip a heater in there if he thought you weren't looking for it. But more time than not, it was not. With you, it was different because you would mix in that curveball and you had that secondary pitch, which was a good pitch, not an 80-mile-an-hour heater. But you had that legit curveball that you could flip in when you thought you needed a strike. Because it seemed to me, if my memory serves me right, you were pretty accurate with that curveball.
Yeah, I mean, that really was my go-to pitch always, even before I threw the knuckleball. You know, I had a good curveball that, you know, I could change speeds with it, and I could drop it in there any time. I didn't mind throwing it 3-2. I didn't mind throwing it 3-1 to get myself back in the count, 2-0. I go right to the curveball. I had that much confidence in that pitch. But ultimately, when the game was on the line, then it was going to be knuckleball. You know, if you're going to beat me, I'm not going to lose on a curveball. I'm not going to lose on my fastball. You're going to have to hit a knuckleball to beat me. And if you do, you know, I'll tip my hat to you. You know, but certain guys, and you were probably one of them, that, all right, you know, why is he always not swinging at my knuckleball? You know, you just seemed like you were just sitting on a curveball. And then one time I threw a curveball and you knocked it out of the park.
Curveball. Believe me, because I think I took Wakefield deep, R.A. Dickey, and it's complete luck. You know how the knuckleball is. It's like if you throw a good one, I don't care who you are, the greatest of the greats. If you throw your good one, we're not going to square it up. That's just the way it is. So with you, I thought, why am I going to battle him in that knuckleball? Because he's going to embarrass me. He's going to throw one of his good ones. He's going to drop out of the zone. I'm going to swing and miss it. So I thought maybe that great knuckleball will be a ball. And if I don't look for that, and I just look at the top of where your release point is for that curveball. And if I get that, I know if I'm looking for it and Tommy throws it to me, I got a chance. But if he throws me that good knuckleball, I probably got about a 10% chance at best that it's slow pitch softball now. It's basically, right. You know, swing where you think it's going to land. So I did with you. I just said, screw it. If he throws me three great knuckleballs, I'm probably going to have a seat and hopefully I can manipulate a curveball out of him. The problem I didn't do with guys like a Trevor Hoffman who just had that unbelievable changeup. The mistake I made with him was I kept sitting on the changeup. Because I thought I can't continue to get embarrassed by this changeup that looks like a fastball. So I'd sit on the changeup. Then Trevor started throwing me, get me over fastballs for strike one. I'm going, oh, man. You know, when we're buddies and I'm looking at him, I didn't like that at all. But, yeah, you know, that was
funny, too, with switch hitters. So this happened with Bobby Bonilla. It also happened with Carlos Beltran. So Beltran one game starts off left-handed. And I strike him out on knuckleballs, right? Great, whatever. He comes up his next at bat, and he's hitting right-handed. And I said, okay, well, I threw him three curveballs, struck him out. Next at bat, he comes up left-handed again. And Bobby Bonilla used to tell me, he goes, look, I'm going to hit right-handed off you because right now I have a good stroke going on the left side, and I'm not about to let you mess it up. And that's what he used to say.
Did you ever have to get in the box against – as a hitter against a knuckleball?
Yeah, against Wake.
Oh, and so now you know what it was like.
Yeah, it was funny. I said, oh, man, this is going to be great. I went up there, first pitch, you know, it was a knuckleball. I swung so hard. I was going to try to hit a home run. I swung so hard, the ball went about like 6 feet in front of the plate. And I was laughing. He was laughing. I mean, everyone was laughing all the way down the line. You know, I almost killed myself swinging so hard. Yeah, that was something. You know, another funny story with Charlie is you remember Kevin Gross?
Without a doubt.
Okay, so Kevin Gross,
big curveball.
Yeah, good fastball. You know, he was one of my buddies with the Dodgers.
Right.
And he's one of the guys that I would play catch with like every day. He wanted to throw his knuckleball and stuff, so I always played knuckleball catch with him. So the Marlins are coming in town, and he's going to pitch against Charlie Hutt. Now, Charlie's like 45 years old at the time. Right. And so I said, you got to throw Charlie a knuckleball. And he goes, oh, no, I don't know if I can do that. I go, he's not going to hit the ball out of the ballpark. OK, he's 45 years old, you know. And so, you know, Charlie comes up. Nobody's on base. you know, Kevin looks in the dugout and I'm going, yeah, throw it now, right? And so I'll be darned, he throws Charlie Huff a knuckleball and it comes out and it hits Charlie right in the helmet. And I never laughed so hard. I lost it. I just lost it. You know, Kevin's down, Charlie's cracking up, you know, and Charlie's going like, what are you doing? You know, and so I asked Charlie that the other day when I was talking to him. I said, do you remember facing Kevin Gross and he threw you a knuckleball? And he goes, why did he do that?
So it's we were just messing around.
He was messing around. You know, everyone wants to throw a knuckleball.
How about the okay? It's now I'm really interested in this mental side of the game. All of us are mentally crazy people, the guys that play in the big leagues. We just are. In between, you said you always had to throw because you always had to make sure you had it. Does that grind on you? Like, okay, you're starting on Thursday and all right, I'm going to go out and have a little catch today on Tuesday. I ain't got it. It's not working. Is that weighing on you? Like, hopefully I got it tomorrow. Hopefully I got it tomorrow. And then tomorrow comes, you warm up a little bit. You don't have it. Now you go in, it's your start day. You're down to the bullpen getting ready. How good of a grip did you have on what the outcome was going to be on a given day by the pregame, warming up before the start? Did you have a pretty good idea how it was going to go, or were you fooled like the rest of us? Sometimes I had unbelievable batting practices where I felt like, get me out of here. I'm too good today. And book it. I usually went 0-for-4 that night because I felt too good. Explain to me in the bullpen, getting ready for a game, the range of thoughts that went through your brain because of the knuckleball you had that day.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Man, you nailed it. I mean, it weighed on me heavily, not knowing if I'm going to have a good knuckleball that day or not. You know, is it going to be a 2-inning day and I give up 8 runs, or is it going to be an 8-inning day and I give up 2 runs? You know, what's it going to be today? And that's where I relied on being a pitcher. You know, if I don't have my knuckleball to start that game, you know what? I'm going to try to get through the first inning. I know everyone's going to be looking for a knuckleball. I don't have it. I'm not going to force it. I'm going to come in with curveballs and try to throw a little cutter and, you know, once try to surprise somebody with a fastball until I start developing the feel of the knuckleball. And sometimes that would usually come back to me. For me, when I was able to throw a good curveball, it seemed like the knuckleball would follow. You know, it's the same mechanics, the same everything. You know, it's like you probably heard Charlie say it many times. It's throwing a knuckleball is like an over-exaggerated game of catch. You know, it's like catch plus. And so I just kind of tamed myself down a little bit, and where I was able to throw enough to get that feel. If I had a side workout and it was garbage, all right, I'd go in just to get away from it for a little bit. And then I'd come out, I'd find somebody else and play catch with them until I go, oh, there it is. But I'd have to have that feel every single day. I'd have to have that feel. I always questioned myself, you know, whether, you know, it's that good or not. You know, it's different when you have a fastball and you're throwing, you know, upper 90s and stuff like that. You know, guys can still hit that. It's just about, you know, putting the ball, you know, where you need to put it. With a knuckleball, you know, I always looked at the catcher, like right in the mask. And that's where I tried to throw it. And that ball would either go down right, go down left, or go down. And once in a while, you get that little circular that would go up there. But for the most part, you know, I would that triangle. I was in that triangle for the most part, but you don't want a thing to spin and spin, you know, because spin is like, especially if it's side spin or back spin, you know, that's when it looks like the ball to Wakefield through to your brother. You know, it's just going to back up. It's just going to go a long ways. You know, as soon as you let go of it, you know, this is going to be ugly. You know, not too many guys hit a good knuckleball, but I had to have that feeling, like when I left the park that day, that, yeah, I got it. It's almost like you have to keep reassuring yourself. So it was a lot different, you know, early in my career. You know, it was like, all right, I curveball, whatever, you know, I'll manipulate, try to get ground balls, try to get whatever. But throwing a knuckleball, if I don't have it, you know, I'm going to have to battle with my other stuff till it comes to me. And sometimes that's not a good thing.
Yeah, you know, you're right, though. I mean, we all do through our journey. You know, as a hitter, I've got to have a defense. When my swing is just completely off, I'm not seeing spin, I'm not seeing anything, I have to have an emergency position to go to where I can at least compete today. I might not go 3 for 4 with a couple homers, but I've got to find a way to battle and put this ball in play today because I ain't got it. We learn that as time goes on. As a golfer, I think about this all the time, Candy. A couple years ago, and I hate saying the word, but I got the shanks. And we were at a celebrity event, and I had a little bit I was playing. I forget who I was playing with, but we had a little bit of a gallery. And you know when you shank the first one, it's like, everybody pretends they didn't see it. Then you do it again. And it's like, now all of a sudden you got them. And I always thought to myself, I couldn't imagine being a tour player, getting a case of the shanks on a Saturday or a Sunday. What do you do? And I'm sure for them, they have an emergency swing they go to that can fix that. And just today I haven't got my good stuff, but I've just got to ping it around the course to survive. As a hitter, I did it. And I'm sure as you matured and got more experience as a pitcher, okay, it's emergency mode. I know where to go right now, and I've got a fighting chance. I might not pitch my best game, but I'll give my team a chance to win.
Yeah, you're on the money with that. Early in your career, when you're not sure if you quite belong or if you happen to have, you know, 2, 3, 4 bad outings or subpar outings in a row, you might not be in the major leagues.
Right.
And so that was always wearing on you. God, am I good enough to be up here? Are they going to let me go? You know, you have all these things going through your mind. And then as you get a little bit more established and you know that you're not going to get sent down to the minor leagues or released or anything like that, you have that leeway where you can relax a little bit. And that's when it seems like you kind of take off, probably as a hitter too. Yeah. And also as a pitcher, you know, they said, look at, you got 10 starts. Just go out there and show us what you can do. Then, you know, that is such a relief for a guy knowing that, you know, he's just not going to get sent down to AAA the next day after a bad outing.
Yeah, I think about that throughout my career. And I've got a son-in-law of mine now is a shortstop for the Oakland A's. And I talked to him about it. Breaking in, establishing yourself. It's so nice once you get to that point where you don't have to show up to spring training and put up numbers. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Of course, I'm not going to lie to you. When I was, you know, late in my career, you know, 14 year veteran, I still want to get a hit every at bat. I don't care where we are in a backfield in a B game. I'd be lying if I said it didn't matter. I want to get a hit, but it wasn't essential to me making the team. I could go in and get my swing ready because I knew April 1st is when it counted. So you're right. Once you establish yourself, it's much easier to get your work in and prepare because you know you're going to be there when the bell rings. All right, I'm going to not take too much more of your time, but I heard there's a story. You're with the Oakland A's. Rick Peterson, your nail breaks right before you're set to pitch. Is this true?
It happened a few times. It did. And
what was his advice? Rick Peterson, for those of you listening to the Boom Podcast, he's a world famous pitching coach, long time in the big leagues. All right, go ahead.
So it absolutely did. And I believe we were in Seattle at that time. But all of a sudden, you know, I'm pitching in the, you know, getting ready to throw, you know, on the side. And I throw a ball and I just feel like just a dagger of heat going down my arm. I'm going, what was that? And so I look at my nail and half of it's gone. And I'm going, oh my God, it's that fake nail that I had on. It just came off. So what do I do? And Rick goes, we'll get someone else. I go, no, no, no. I can get through this. I'm going to be a regular pitcher again. So I went out there as a regular pitcher, and boy, did I get lit up.
They were on to you early.
Of course, I think I was 40 years old or 41 years old at that point too. So, you know, things weren't quite the same as when I was like 28.
All right, last thing I'll let you go. Is it true? First big league baseball player to have his own website.
That is true.
What year happened. And why'd you do it? And you're the reason for all our social media problems.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, I don't know. I was playing for the Dodgers at that time, and some guy came up and he gave me this computer thing, and I don't even know what it is. And he goes, do you mind if, you know, we do a website? And I go, I don't even know what a website is. I don't know anything. You got to think back to the, you know, to 1997, I think it was. And so the guy, I don't even know his name anymore, built it out. And he said, I did it for Oscar De La Hoya, and I'm going to do it for you. And I said, okay, whatever. You know, it's not costing me anything. That's fine. You know, do whatever you got to do to it. And sure enough, had a website. And then he says, you got to start doing this. I go, oh, no. I can't answer. I don't know. I don't have time to do that. I'd rather go worry about my golf swing than getting on a computer and answering somebody. But that was true. I was the first ball player to have one.
Well, Candy, this has been a lot of fun, man. I appreciate you coming on and talking. A lot of interesting stuff and behind the scenes, behind the curtain of a niche. There's only a few of you that have these stories and you are our nemesis, and I'm glad I took you deep that one time on that curveball. Really happy. Because when I was talking to Charlie, I looked up our stats because Charlie's been, man, he's been like a father figure to me for so long, and then I end up playing against him in the big leagues. And I'm thinking, all right, how did I do against Charlie? I remember, because my career against the knuckleball in general, not anything to write home about. I've got a few good points here and there, but I look at Charlie and I was 0-6. So I had nothing for Charlie. Charlie owned me, you know, maybe it was a Boone thing. You owned my dad. So the whole deal, but this was a lot of fun. I appreciate it. All the best for you guys over in Arizona this year. I'll be watching you. That's an exciting young team. I want to ask you, you're getting Eugenio Suarez over in, over for the Arizona Diamondbacks. Good player, underrated defender. I've been watching him in Seattle for the last few years. Probably going to pencil him in for 25 or 30 home runs. You've got Rodriguez, I believe, from Detroit in that rotation now. And who's the other pickup you had recently that I was excited about that I saw you guys have?
They end up getting Grichuk and Jock Peterson. Also.
Jock Peterson as a designated hitter. And yeah. Peterson has a knack for finding his way deep in the postseason. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun to watch you guys. Diamondback over under 94 wins.
94. That's a tough one. I'll go a little bit underneath that one, knowing that we got to play the Dodgers a lot. But I think they were scared. We were 84 last year, I think it was.
Yeah.
I'll give us about high 80s, I think, right around 90-ish.
I think that division has a good chance at three teams coming out of the division this year. All right, Candy, thanks again. For those of you out there listening to the Boone Podcast, we're now on YouTube. If you're watching it, I appreciate you tuning in. And until next time, see you then.